This is the Wheeler Centre podcast.
My name is Margaret Simons. I'm Director of the Centre for Advancing Journalism at the University of Melbourne and a journalist. We put on the new news each year in partnership with the Wheeler Centre and with Swinburne University. And this is the third day of what I like to call a festival, not a conference, because it is, broadly speaking, an optimistic look at the future of journalism at a time of enormous change. Now, before we go any further, I'd just like to acknowledge that the new news takes place on the traditional lands of Indigenous Australians and acknowledge their elders past and present and pay respect to any other Indigenous people in the audience today. So we're here to talk about election reporting, and we've got a terrific panel to do that. On my far left, we have Andy Hunter, who is Editor-in-Chief of Microsoft in Australia, and with Hal Crawford, is the author of All Your Friends Like This, How Social Networking Took Over the News, which is a great book, I recommend it. He's also the co-founder of ShareWars, which is a social media project. I also recommend that. Then to his right, we have Mark DiStefano, who is BuzzFeed's political editor and also a former ABC News reporter. And then we have Matthew Knott, a former...
He's also got a book.
Oh, he's also got a book.
Thank you, Matthew. Thank
What a Time to Be Alive, That and Other Lies in the 2016 campaign.
Taking care of me.
which I have on my bedside table. I must confess I haven't yet read it, but anyway.
Okay.
And then we have Matthew Knott, who is a political reporter for Fairfax Media and a former colleague of mine at Crikey. And then immediately to my left, we have Cathy Harper, who is the editor of Election Watch. And Election Watch is currently reporting on the US election, but also reported on the Australian election earlier this year. It draws on the expertise of the University of Melbourne researchers to provide policy analysis and debate. And Cathy has previously worked for ABC, SBS and NPR. Now, we were having some pretty lively email correspondence in the lead up to this, and I was promised by Matthew and Mark, both of whom have been on the bus in the last election campaign. What is the bus, Mark?
So a lot of people don't know that there is a bus for Bill Shorten and there's a bus for Malcolm Turnbull. It consists of a literal bus. It is a coach. And then there's also a plane that follows them around. So what you do is that you pay for the privilege, as a journalist, or your outlet does, pays for the privilege to be on the bus with the leaders. And so you follow around, take for instance Malcolm Turnbull, you jump, you give them 48 hours notice, you tell the Prime Minister's office that you want to jump on, they take your details down, and then you show up at a hotel like the Intercontinental in Sydney. And then you follow around the leader for the day. And it usually consists of driving around western suburbs of Sydney or out of Melbourne and a flight every day, which is a private plane. And then you stay in a hotel with the Prime Minister as well. And it costs, and this is the important thing, I think, is that it costs a lot of money. Like it costs, you pay the Prime Minister's office, and it costs about $2,000 a day. Now, $2,000 a day for a BuzzFeed or a Fairfax, it's okay. But when it's an eight-week election campaign and you're trying to have one journo on each one and a photographer on each one, you start getting into this thing where, I mean, I did some rough calculations. It probably would have cost the ABC upwards of about $800,000 to have all its cameramen, its journos, for the whole eight-week campaign. And they have to because they're the ABC. But where BuzzFeed have to figure out is that we're really lean in many ways. We're a startup in our own minds kind of thing. And we only went on when we had news that we wanted to cover. So we went on the last weeks. And if you pay $2,000 a day, you have the potential of cut... Like, Mal, I was talking to Matthew about this in the final week. There's potentially 7 to 8 questions he answers a day from the journos on the bus.
On a good day.
On a good day. Yeah, sometimes it's less. Sometimes it's 3 or 4. Malcolm Turnbull will do morning radio... He'll do morning TV. If you're going to, if there are 30 journos there and everyone's trying to yell and get his attention and you don't get a question that day, well, then I go to my boss, like he goes, how is, like, you know, what story you got? And I'm like, well, like it's all about local jobs in submarine jobs in Adelaide. And it's like, well, that's not really going to fly with our audience.
Now, Matthew, is it worthwhile, this bus? Is it value for money? And also, I know you two have an anecdote to tell about how you tried to make it work.
Yeah, well, this was a big decision for Fairfax. I don't think I'm breaking any company secrets to say that it's been a financially troubled company and we don't have as much money as we used to, and this was twice as long as a normal election campaign. So a decision was made early that for at least 2 weeks in the middle of it, we wouldn't have anyone out on the road. We would just report from Canberra or Sydney and Melbourne where we were. And I was out on the first week with Bill Shorten and then came back, and then we went off the road and this became known, and I found it kind of disappointing because we got a lot of praise for not putting anyone out there. And people were saying, good on Fairfax, you're getting off the bus. And I was more, oh, shouldn't we actually be getting... I'd rather get credit for going out there and you're trying, you're doing your best to try and ask questions and hold them accountable and find out what's going on. But we got praised for taking people off for what honestly was a money-saving decision. But I can totally understand why. The thing now is that it's all broadcast. Anyone who wants to watch it can see every press conference they want on 24 or Sky. Mm. So just reporting what the Prime Minister said at the press conference isn't particularly valuable. I remember there was one early on in Cairns, I think it was, and Malcolm Turnbull did a press conference and he said, I'm only taking questions from the local media. And I know that made our organisation very angry because he said, we're paying for someone to come out and you only get one or two chances a day to ask questions, and you're saying... It was on the day that Peter Dutton said about illiterate refugees stealing our jobs, and he said, I'm only taking questions on the local economy here. So there were very angry phone calls saying, we're not going to pay for our reporters to be out reporting on the news if you're not going to even let them ask questions anymore. So it is difficult, but I still have some belief that you'd rather have people, and from a variety of different outlets, people have different interests to... It's the only chance you get each day to ask the leader any questions, so I still think the more people, the better, even though a lot of people seem to think that it's quite worthless.
Now, tell me the story of your dastardly scheme.
Yeah, well, it was really funny. Matthew and I, it was the last week of the election, and if people remember, Julie Bishop and Scott Morrison had sort of mentioned in interviews about the same-sex marriage plebiscite that they wouldn't potentially, they wouldn't vote. If it came back as a yes, they didn't actually say they would vote yes in the parliament. It was a huge issue. It's no secret that it's a massive issue for the BuzzFeed audience. And I said to Matt, like, I was trying so hard to get a question in at the press conference, and and Malcolm Turnbull, when he goes to ask questions, he's very and he should get praised for this. He goes to women a lot. He goes to the young women journos in a presser because men can shout louder. But he'll point out where he wants to take the questions. Now, of course, and every leader does this, Bill Shorten does this, he takes questions from friendly journos. And Matthew and I just couldn't get a question for 2 days. And it was just like, I was just like going, shit, like this is so bad. Like, I had this conversation with Matthew and we sort of said, well, why don't we sort of like all come at him? And I had a conversation with a few other journos, like Tim Lester from Channel 7 and a few others, trying to explain to them why the plebiscite issue was huge and a potential flashpoint. And we had this sort of weird Chinese yum cha, you know, lunch in Western Sydney, and we were all packed into this room, and he's talking about the latest terror attack in Ankara, and he's talking, and he sort of pauses to sort of say questions, and Matthew yells, Prime Minister! And he goes, no, and he keeps going, and that sort of indication sort of sent a signal to the rest of the journos that Matthew was going to be the first person to ask a question. But what happened was that when he said, questions now, I jumped in and I asked about the plebiscite, and then the second person who... And then he snapped at me. He had a, you know, thanks for your long question, essentially. He had a bit of a snap. And then he took a second question from Matthew, and then essentially the whole press pack noticed that he was prickly about this issue. So they all came in, and there was 8 questions, one after the other, on the plebiscite. And that night, Laurie Oakes had this big sort of, in his monologue, he sort of talked about how Malcolm Turnbull is in a bad mood. And it was like that thing where it was really satisfying for me, and I'm sure for Matthew, it was like, this is how it should work. You know, like, journos, we all went off script. And I found out a couple of days later that they were, you know, the PMO were really angry at us, that, like, you're talking about issues that no one cares about, you know.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And that was the amazing thing when you look back on it, is that it was a few days out from the election campaign and we actually had no idea of how this plebiscite would work. We were getting all these details just kind of... It wasn't until a few days before the election we found out, oh, no, people won't be bound. It's going to be modelled on a referendum. Mm-hmm. And we were going, how has he actually got away with this for so long in Canberra without spelling out the mechanism of what's a really divisive issue? But, yeah, I guess the thing is, journalists, we like to think that we're individuals and we try and avoid running in a pack and you only have one chance a day. So say your newspaper has broken a story, there's a lot of pressure on you. We'll ask questions about our story. So the ABC wants to pursue their story. Fairfax News want to pursue their stories, which means that you can often, someone will ask a question, there's no answer, there's no follow-up. Whereas we were going, really, we should just sit down and work out the three issues we want answered and get together and back each other up. And it kind of, someday, like one day is like, days like that, it really worked and it was a success.
And it created news. And I think there's the problem of being boys on the bus attitude. There's a really famous book written about US elections about this sort of mentality of sitting in the bus and getting to sit next to Malcolm Turnbull or getting to sit next to the president and actually just talking off the record. That just doesn't happen, you know. And I think that in Australia, and this is something that we need to sort of grapple with going forward, is that the reason is because time constraints have gotten to this point where we're constantly filing tweets, live blogs, pictures. We're constantly putting stuff out on Twitter that you don't get a moment to sit, talk to the PMO about what they're trying to do. There's, I don't, like Turnbull's office especially was very hostile, but it was like there's not this off the record, on the record thing that is happening, I think, 20, 30 years ago. And it's like I remember a couple of guys who were a Channel 9 reporter and a Sky reporter. It's like they had to get in bed by 9 o'clock every night because they had to wake up at 4, have read all the papers, and their first cross was at 5:45.
Sensible people. Yeah, now, I'm gonna cut you off there. Yeah. Though we could go all day on that because I want to bring in Kathy and Andy here, both of whom were not on the bus, were in their various ways sitting back and perhaps taking a bit more of a long view. Kathy, you're talking about deep dives on policy and analysis. Are people interested in that anymore, or is it all about the personality politics?
Well, I hope people are interested in it because that's why we exist. look, I think there's no doubt that personality politics reporting kind of gets more hits. Mm-hmm. I think that there's some excellent reporting done in Australia by, you know, my fellow panellists, for example. But I think that there is a problem, generally speaking, with a kind of a obsession, really, with talking about the personality of the leaders and not talking about policy. And I think that this is kind of actually playing out in an extreme way at the moment in the US, where we've got a celebrity candidate, Trump, running for the Republicans. You know, he's not a politician. He has no political experience at all. He's famous for being famous. He's a rich guy who hosted a reality TV show. So Trump, the showman, has totally dominated Clinton, the kind of policy nerd. I think that this is actually an argument that was made by Matt Bay, American journalist. He's the chief political correspondent for Yahoo News and he used to be at the New York Times. He came to Australia recently to Melbourne Uni and was talking about this. And he's saying that the media has a role in this kind of, in the rise of Trump in this way. And you sort of got to wonder what the logical outcome of this. I mean, maybe we'd be seeing President Kanye in a few years. Mm-hmm. I don't know. I mean, I say that as a joke, but, like, you know, sort of there's a feeling at the moment anything could happen. So I think it's, I think that there's too little reporting of policy and ultimately that's what people care about, really.
Well, you had a unique insight into what people care about, Andy. You knew what people were talking about and sharing on social media. Tell us about that.
Yeah, so At ChairWars, we record every single article that's posted to a news homepage in Australia. And so we have a database of about 150,000 stories for June. What the sharing data shows is that people are actually really engaged in the election and that election stories drove about 10% of total sharing through June. So that's, I think that's really positive. And then if you look at the issues that were talked about, gay marriage, the gay marriage plebiscite was number one daylight second.
Number one shared item.
Absolutely. Mm. So these guys' instincts were totally right.
Mm.
And the story, interestingly, the story that Matthew wrote, I think, after you guys double-teamed Malcolm Turnbull, is in the top 10 most shared stories in June. So gay marriage was huge as an issue on Facebook. And, you know, we see Facebook as a very mainstream signal. It's not, you know, it's not just, for example, millennials or, you know, people between the age of, you know, 18 and 25. This is everyone. I don't know, it's quite, I think it's quite gratifying to look at people engaging with the issues on Facebook. And we very much see sharing as a measure of value, so that these are the stories that people actually care about.
Now, you say Facebook is mainstream, this is Australia. I mean, that's the natural question, isn't it? Is Facebook skewing young? Is it skewing wonkish? Is it skewing liberal?
Yeah.
And you're saying no?
Yeah, I mean, it's, you know, I guess it's pretty well the biggest platform in Australia, so everyone's on it.
Mm-hmm.
And, yeah, I mean, what we've seen so far is that people are sharing, around the issues that they care most about, and yeah, I mean, we basically see it as a really mainstream signal, and so the top story by far was gay marriage, and then after that it was fake tradie, and
just remind everybody what fake tradie was about.
Mark wrote the 10th most shared story in June. That
the
was
real fake trader.
Yeah, yeah, and it was really funny. It was in a WA hotel room. It was like 10:30 at night. The YouTube video dropped about the fake tradie.
Just remind everybody
and
what
the
fake tradie
is. And he's a real tradie. It was just like this was an ad, the Liberal Party ad in like the final 2 weeks about this guy, and he had his ceramic mug and he sort of spoke in this really weird sort of intonation, and he was talking about how, you know, about negative gearing, essentially, and he said, you know, what was the slogan? It was something like, give him a go. Like, you know, it was this really strange negative way to support the coalition. Anyway, it blew up on Twitter. So I wrote a story basically saying that, like, everyone's losing their shit about this article, about this video, about this ad. And for about 3 days, it was a big story. I kind of think, you know, those sort of stories, it plays into what Kathy's talking about. It's a personality story. Like I say, it's not a policy story.
It's entertaining.
It's entertaining. It's the water cooler. It's what people will be talking about. Did you see the fake trading? Oh, I saw that video. Wasn't that weird? Yeah. Blah, 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 blah. Like, it is the story everyone's talking about at work the next day. And at BuzzFeed, we try to sort of say to ourselves, like, you know, we want to answer the question, what's everyone talking about on the internet that day? And we want to do some reporting around it. The second thing I just want to say about that on policy, like, I think that that's what's really important now is with social sharing and with the metrics that we get. Like, we have a reporter on LGBT issues, Lane Sainty. She just focuses on the plebiscite. Like, she just does deep dives on the plebiscite. And her stories do really well because
She dominates basically the top 30 gay marriage plebiscite stories that were written by her.
Yeah.
Can I just argue the devil's advocate? I mean, it would be said by some in politics that Australians aren't really concerned about gay marriage. They're concerned about housing prices and electricity prices, even smashed avocados, perhaps.
Yeah.
And you're telling us that we're wrong, or that the politicians who say this are wrong. So how savvy is the political class about social media and its impact on politics?
Well, all I would say is that these stories have life cycles of about 2 or 3 days. Like, say the smashed avo story, it's sort of like it's got about a 3-day life cycle. The first day is outrage, mostly. It's like, look at this thing. Everyone points at it and says, "Oh my god!" And then the opinions day two, and then like by late on day two, there's a counter opinion, and then by day three, it usually filters out into the political class. So with the smashed avo story, bloody Green Senator Peter Whish-Wilson, but he brought an avocado to Senate estimates. So it was like that was literally 4 days after Bernard Salt wrote that column. So those outrage stories, we always talk about BuzzFeed. It's like, you need to get on it quick. Like, if you're first, you define everything, and it's sort of like Facebook really does reward first mover advantage. It's like, if you get your story out on Facebook before anyone else, the metrics go through the roof. And I'm shameless with our team, our politics team. I'm like, if something's breaking, I say, shut down Twitter. Let's focus on getting the story up onto Facebook. It's the most important. Mm.
And Kathy,
you're I was just going to say, it's just so interesting how things can play out on social media and influence the wider debate. In the US, I'm talking about the US because I'm working on that at the moment, there's a woman called Kelly Oxford, who's a writer, and she's very active on social media. And after the Trump tape was published by the Washington Post, where he boasted about groping and kissing women without their consent, she invited people on Twitter to tweet her their stories of unwanted sexual advances or sexual assault. And she had this massive, massive response. She says there was a million responses in one day, and then it continued on for a long time. But a response like that, not only does it make mainstream news, but it really goes to an actual point that it makes it a lot harder for people to say, no, that's not just locker room talk. And I think that feeds into the wider debate about an issue or politics in an election campaign.
Oh, I was just going to say, I think Laura Tingle wrote about it, and she talked about same-sex marriage and why it actually is probably important to 10 or 15% of people very strongly at either end of the political spectrum. But as an issue, it has everything because it's easy to understand. Everyone knows what marriage is. You've got colourful characters on all the sides. You've got division. It's just a moving, colourful feast, which everyone can relate to and get excited about and feel emotional about, whereas childcare policy, which probably affects more people, is incredibly complicated, and the benefit and the subsidy. And that was, for example, what could have been a big issue from the campaign, but it wasn't an issue at all. And we probably haven't thought enough about how we make those stories interesting, because things like the fake tradie, that's just a gimme. That's going to be interesting and sexy and everyone's going to want to share it. But I know we've seen at Fairfax that we did this big investigation. I didn't, but Nick McKenzie and Richard Baker, on corruption in the oil industry. And it's actually not something that affects people in their ordinary lives. People could easily think it's very boring, but I know a massive amount of effort went into what is the headline, how do we make this sexy, how do we make the bring the colourful characters out, and it did incredibly well. But a lot of time and effort has to go into how do we make this difficult story relatable and get people to share it on Facebook. And we probably, in an election campaign, you're living so day-to-day, we haven't thought out enough in advance. Well, how do we make education policy relatable, or tax cuts? How do we make that exciting?
Exactly. So that's the key to being a good editor and having a good editorial management in place, and to an extent being a good journalist, because if it's important, we should be able to make it interesting. It's not always easy to do, but that's, I think, where the really good journos kind of earn their money.
Mm. We'll spend in the editorial process every morning. I don't want to put a number on it, but say potentially about 20% of the time is focused on what we say is framing. So like focusing on what will the headline be and what will the thumbnail. Because we know that the success of our stories on Facebook will be about what that headline is and what that thumb picture is. And we spend a lot of time fretting about what's the thumb. You know, what is that picture? And just on the personality politics versus policy, I just want to I don't want to boost Matthew's ego too much because it's already too big. But it's there was this moment earlier this year, and I think this is really instructive and shows that people do care about policy. And when it intersects with personality, it goes nuts. There was a moment earlier this year, if people remember, that Malcolm Turnbull had this crazy idea to give GST collection, income tax collection over to the states. It was this trial balloon, and it was ridiculous. And it was he gave this interview to Fran Kelly. And if people notice these days, is that whenever the Prime Minister or Bill Shorten gives an interview, there'll be about a dozen journos live tweeting every single thing, and I do it, and Matthew does it, and other journos do it, and it was this really thing. He gave this interview, and it was at 8:15 or something, and at 9:45 this story popped up on Twitter, and it went straight to the top of Reddit and straight to the top of Facebook, and it was from Matthew, and it was Prime Minister admits that he'll keep funding private schools and cut off funding to public schools. And it was this thing I just went, and I DM'd him. I was like, you bastard. I was like, that was it. I was like, you completely, he framed the whole debate around, it was a throwaway comment that he said, of course, Fran, if of course the states will be funding public schools, but we have to keep funding private schools. And it played into this debate. It outraged so many people because it played into this thing of Malcolm Turnbull wants to cut off funding for public schools and keep funding private schools. And it was a policy story, but it played into our personality politics as well. Mm. And I think that that's the thing, is you just need to have that thing always of listening to how can I frame this, take this grab and actually paint a broader picture for the audience. And I think that that was a really instructive way to do it.
Now we've got, it's really notable that on it's the stage notable. And among the top shared stories, as Andy has told us, we've got some tiny newsrooms, some tiny and some new newsrooms. How many people in your newsroom, Kathy?
Three.
How many in yours?
I think we've got six.
Yeah, six. And Fairfax, while larger, is shrinking, as previously acknowledged. How has new media changed sort of ecology around political reporting, Andy?
Well, I think it gives direct access for the people who are good at it and who have great followings. It gives them a platform to go direct to a large audience immediately. And it allows people to not only own the story, but as Mark does quite a bit, kind of own the pre-story. So, you know, I'm going to be writing about this today. Has anyone seen anything on this? And so the audience on Twitter on Twitter mainly is getting primed for the story. Then he drops the story, and then you know everyone reads the story.
People feel as though they're part of you writing the story as well. Yeah. So like, I'm pretty shameless about it. I always say it's like journalists aren't experts quite often. Journalists are there to report, and it's like, Twitter is amazing because it's like the experts are out there. You just need to ask. Yeah. And then like the best one was the Mark Latham story was about us uncovering Mark Latham's dumbass Twitter account. It was like, I literally tweeted, is at real Mark Latham the real Mark Latham? And my direct messages were full within an hour from famous female media personalities being like, it's him, and telling me why.
Yeah.
And it all started with me asking Twitter. And I think that's... I'm shameless by it, and there are two things. It's like, do that, and then the other version of it is keep everything close to your chest, keep your cards, and then show them, which is like what Matthew did with the Radio National interview, which is like, don't tweet about it. If you hear the grab, put it in a story and then put it out.
Now, Andy, we're often hearing that newspapers like The Australian, for example, and Fairfax as well, but The Australian is often mentioned, are extremely politically influential, and certainly politicians seem to take a lot of notice of them. Are they right to do that or not, in your view?
I think this is the million-dollar question, and people... particularly in Sydney, look at the Daily Telegraph and the power and influence of the Daily Telegraph. I think it's something that continues to shift one way and the other. And I think a lot of people in Sydney anyway were talking about the waning influence of the Daily Telegraph and Alan Jones. And then Mike Baird went and backflipped on the Greyhounds, and everyone went, oh my God, you know, Alan Jones is back.
Because the Telegraph had just recently run a campaign against Clover Moore, which completely backfired.
Yep.
And they ran a campaign against Bill Shorten in Western Sydney, which completely backfired.
Yep.
And I think that there was very much a debate in Sydney about the Telegraph keeps losing its campaigns.
Yeah. And is that right? Is it
absolutely? Well, I mean, just looking at the Telegraph, I think over the past year, it's not necessarily for me to say, but it looks like they have lost some of these key campaigns, and people do begin to question exactly how much influence it has.
I was talking to a former political spin doctor in the Victorian government the other day about this, and he was saying, look at Andrews. He got elected despite the fact that the Herald Sun was campaigning against him, and that probably wouldn't have happened maybe 10 years ago because the Herald Sun was more influential then. And he said, gone are the days where if, as a government, you have a bad story that appears in the morning in the Herald Sun, it's run all day on 3RW, it pops up again in the evening on Channel 7, and you've had the whole day of a really negative story. He said those days are over because there's so many more sources that journalists are using for their news, and the audience is looking for stuff in so many different sources.
But the other thing is that, having worked over at Nine for quite a few years... looking at the way that the Telegraph sets the agenda for today, And not just the Telegraph, of course, the Herald Sun, to an extent the Australian as well. But, you know, those breakfast TV shows are still using the tabloids to help with their news list setting. Each morning.
Yeah. Kathy, what's your maximum impact? What's the story that you would pick out as saying, well, that's the one that, you know, had some impact?
You mean our most read story? Well, our most read story was on the Australian federal election was a piece by John Brumby about how the political system is basically fundamentally broken and needs to be redone. But one of the most popular stories was not about policy. It was a really fun story that we did. We asked a whole lot of political scientists at Melbourne Uni what their favourite political TV shows were. So it was like the top 10 political TV shows as voted by political scientists. And they had some interesting things to say about each show and why they liked it. And that was really popular. Mm. Yeah.
That's interesting.
I was just going to say that, not to sugarcoat, I know that, remember during the campaign, which was so long, we're probably forgetting how boring everyone thought it was at the time. There was definite disappointment, I think, in Fairfax at the lack of interest during the campaign in the election. It was seen as... And the problem, I think, is that once a decision has been made that something is boring, then it's very hard to get a politics story up the top of the website. And whereas as soon as it was a close result, in the weeks after, everyone wanted to read about politics and there was much more interest in the politics stories that we were writing. And we found that bizarre because we were quite tired after this 8-week campaign and then no one seemed to care when it was happening. And then suddenly nothing was actually happening. The vote had been held, but there was massive interest in the development in various seats and the count, and people really tuned in. At the end, during the campaign, there was a feeling that people weren't interested in
it. And you, tired though you were, wrote quite a controversial story, which you tell me you're still ducking about, and you interviewed me for it, so it was brilliant. But you said that the media got it wrong, the press gallery got it wrong, or you asked the question, did they get it wrong? Tell us about that.
Well, it wasn't that long ago, but even you have to remember back to the mood during the campaign. Obviously, we had election night and the result was incredibly close. We didn't know who was going to win or if it was going to be a hung parliament or not. And I was asked, oh, look, by my editor, I think there's a story to do on whether the media and the press gallery misread the result of the election, because as it was at the time, I think there was a big feeling of Malcolm Turnbull has all this momentum in the last few days. He's been winning the campaign. There were stories coming out in the last few days about will Anthony Albanese replace Bill Shorten? Could Malcolm Turnbull be picking up these various seats in Western Sydney? And it didn't happen that way. And so I thought, okay, I'll ring around and try. And I tried to get feedback because, you know, we're in Canberra, we're talking to each other a lot. And I was actually told, you know, don't be defensive. I don't just want this to be a piece to be, the media got it right, you're all wrong. So I tried to ask people on social media, what did you think of our coverage? Did we get things right or wrong? What would you like next time? And speak to people like Margaret and Jonathan Holmes, who are outside of Canberra. And then I did a piece which essentially said, well, yes, I do think the media got it wrong. I think we overestimated Malcolm Turnbull and underestimated Bill Shorten, speaking generally. But perhaps here are some reasons why. Even Labor, to a certain extent, were surprised by results in certain areas. Put it out there.
The interesting thing was that the polls were calling it neck and neck the whole way through.
Yes.
And no one seemed to believe the polls.
And that's what... one of the funny things was, I was talking to people and I said, oh, did we get it wrong? And they said, oh, yeah, we didn't believe our own polls. We didn't believe the polls we were commissioning showing it was incredibly close. Mm-hmm. But one of the funny things was, I think when I wrote it, as soon as it was out there, I went back to some of the same people a day later and they didn't know if they agreed with my story. I was like, I was talking to you about it yesterday and you said we got it totally wrong. But as soon as it's been written in print, then people get quite defensive about it. And, you know, some people didn't agree and they said the media and the press gallery isn't this collective that you paint it.
Well, that's really my next question. I mean, when I had my encounters with the press gallery, which admittedly is about 20 years ago, and then I was actually there for a while, it was incredibly clubby and people did go in a pack and there was a price to be paid if you stepped outside and criticised journalists are the thinnest skinned people on the planet, as I've found to my cost.
Although we criticise everyone else.
Although we criticise everyone else. Now, you've gone in and done political reporting in a slightly different way.
Yep.
You wrote that piece, which was extremely critical. What's the price that you pay?
Well, I mean, I think that you've got to play two games. And you've got to be savvy about it, is that, like, Alice Workman's our press gallery reporter. She's very much... she's on the press gallery committee. We got her from Triple J. It was a very smart business decision, I believe, from our editor to hire her, because she's in the tent. And that allowed me to come in and throw bombs from outside the tent. So between the two of us, we actually work as a bit of a duo, and that's the thing. The price to be paid, I mean, like, I've had threats from journalists who have said, you know, your career is going to go down the toilet because of this. And I just laugh. I would just be like, oh, you think we get drops.
And what sort of things are they talking about when they say this?
Well, because it's...
Is it the listicles?
On the record stuff. I mean, this is something that I've talked about a lot in the last couple of months, is that there's very much a mentality within the press gallery, and obviously Matthew can correct me, is that people need to protect access and protect relationships, which is probably the most foundational component of journalism, right? You have your sources and your source relationships. I've got my sources as well, and I don't burn them. But I truly believe that we need to get to a more mature stage where we don't protect politicians from scrutiny as much as we do at the moment. I had a very senior journo at the Midwinter Ball. The Midwinter Ball is like the big off the record piss up. Couldn't have anything more emblematic to do with this discussion, which is everyone gets drunk together and it's all off the record. Literally, like, pointing at me, saying that my career is going to go down the toilet, and I'd just been roasted by Malcolm Turnbull and Bill Shorten by name. And it's like, oh, you don't realise that actually bucking the game can get you way more respect from within the system and get you noticed as well. So I think that you need to play the game, and I definitely do. And I have very good friends in the press gallery, and I always play. But then if you can actually even be seen to be not playing the game, and this is what, you know, always remember your audience is outside. Your audience is looking in, and if you're being a bit of a shit, you get a lot of credibility from doing that.
And what's the cost been to you of writing that piece?
Oh, I mean, I think people move. Yeah, some people didn't like it, or some people were quite reasoned in their... And then they said, oh, you know, we think you're generalising too much. And my response to that was, well, I don't think people out there are parsing each different thing that the Guardian and the Herald and the Telly are writing. I think people get a generalistic impression during the campaign. And I think that campaign was that Malcolm Turnbull was winning quite easily. But then some people said, you know, you're an ignorant person just trying to get attention. And certain people who I talked to in the corridor weren't really looking at me anymore. But I think people have gotten over it and people move on. But it's probably a healthy view that we don't criticise each other all the time, but we should reflect every now and then.
And what was the impact of that story on social media, Andy? Do you know? It's this one, if people want to read it. Headlined, Election 2016, The Uncomfortable Truth Is the Media Got It Wrong.
Yeah, so I haven't actually looked at the sharing of that one. It didn't make the top... the top 2,000, which is the... but that's out of 120,000 stories.
Don't tell the editor.
So, I mean, as a consumer, I loved reading that story. I thought it was fantastic at the time. Mark sent it around by email the other day again. I read it again. You know, I thought it was fascinating. I thought it was brave.
There's nothing the media like more than reading about itself.
Yeah. No, I can. It's a former media reporter.
It's like things like this. People love talking about themselves.
Now, Kathy, we've been talking about social media, obviously, as a huge change to the ecology of political reporting. But does it also mean that we don't know what's true and what's false? And what are we going to do about that?
I don't know what we're going to do about it. I think... it's been interesting to see how some of these issues have been playing out in the American election, because it's probably the most kind of fact-free election campaign in the history of the whole world. Mm. and obviously Trump is the main offender there, although Clinton hasn't told the truth 100% of the time. I mean, I think she's made some claims in debates that are a little bit fuzzy, you know, sort of covered in spin and that kind of thing. But that's more of the thing that we'd sort of come to expect from politicians. We don't expect them to kind of outright lie. Which Trump has done on many occasions. Look, it's interesting. One of the biggest lies that he's been involved with is this right-wing racist conspiracy theory that Obama wasn't born in the US. It's been around for a long time, but Trump gave it a lot of oxygen until about a month ago when he finally came out and said, okay, I accept that this is not true. So it was a really big story and it was covered by everyone, you know. Most people kind of reported it in a straight way that I would have done too myself, I've got to say, just reporting the facts, you know, Trump has admitted that blah, blah, blah. But it was interesting, the New York Times did something different and they put on the front page, which is almost never happens, a piece of analysis rather than a piece of straight news. And the headline on the piece was Trump gives up a lie, I think. So first of all, they called it out as an actual lie. Usually journalists don't accuse politicians of straight out lying. And then they ran this different type of piece and the news was relegated to sort of page 10 or something, I think. So it was interesting. I guess the editors felt like this was such a big issue to just kind of report on it straight, didn't really get to the heart of the magnitude of the lie that had been going on and that Trump had deliberately inflamed. So I think that's an interesting way to handle it. I'm not sure whether you'd really do that for a reissue. Well, certainly not, but it's an interesting sort of way of reporting something differently to
just
how you normally would.
On that, Meg, if I could, I've been reading about all that, this debate about whether you should call out lies in America, and I think I found it quite influential, the debate over there, and the New York Times doing that, because I know the other day this report came out, it was about government advertising and it was about all these ads you might remember about university deregulation. And what the report essentially laid out is that the ads were totally untruthful. They said you're going to keep paying, the government will keep paying half of your degree, and it was only about 39%, which isn't half at all. But it was a bureaucratic report just laying out the facts. And I was like, this is, because I'd covered this issue, and I thought, this is amazing. And I just wrote it up, you know, the government misled the public, blah, 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 going through what the report said. And a staffer rang me up and said, oh, I think you've gone very, very strong here. You know, the report doesn't say it in those words. And I say, well, the report lays out these facts, and my conclusion is, based on what I know, that you have misled the public, and I tell me how that is wrong. And then they just went away, and then later that day I bumped into them. This is kind of what Mark describes in his book, is these interactions, and I bumped into them at the coffee shop and I was like, oh, you know, I'm sorry about that. And he said, oh no, you're totally fine. But you know, people try and intimidate you into changing it. But I thought, well, just because the report didn't say in black and white they lie, it doesn't mean we shouldn't join a few dots and back yourself and say, well, actually, that was basically bullshit.
Can I just say, the Trump birther thing, I mean, this is a very different bite, but if you bring it back home, the Medi-Scare stuff with Bill Shorten, I was on Bill Shorten's bus for the second last week of the campaign, and there was nothing as infuriating as trying to call out Bill Shorten and his scare campaign on Medicare, because as soon as I watched this young reporter from the Courier-Mail, and he'd clearly been given these questions from News Corp head office about how to nail him. And he was getting so angry during the press conference. He's like, you're lying. You're lying to everyone. And Bill Shorten just with a smile, like picked up his Medicare card and just kept talking about Medicare. And it didn't matter that all of this, like, you know, Laura Tingle writes a piece for The Fin, like calling out the lie, all this sort of stuff. It didn't matter because I spoke to Bill Shorten's press secretary and I said, you're going to do this every day of the campaign, aren't you? And he said, my job is to have two images of Bill Shorten on the nightly news every day, Bill Shorten running in the morning and Bill Shorten visiting sick kids. And he goes, that was all they did for the final weeks. And it's like that thing of saying post-fact, it's like it didn't matter if Bill Shorten was spreading lies about Medicare. All it mattered was that we were talking about Medicare. And that's this whole, you know, dead cat theory. We can all talk about it later, but it's like, that I thought was so instructive because I was watching it being like, you could throw as many facts at him right now and he's just going to be holding that Medicare card and he's going to win about the issue.
Yeah, really interesting. Now, I want to take questions from the audience very shortly, so start composing your questions if you have one. But just before we do that, I want you to ask you each very briefly to respond to this question. We're going to have another election, maybe soon. But at least in the normal cycle, not too soon. Still recovering, are we?
Yeah.
If you were God of the world, God of political reporting, and could introduce one single improvement to political reporting in Australia, what would it be? Do you want to have a go at that first, Kathy? Sorry, whoever okay. goes first off the rank.
All right, well, I'll say it's not exactly new, but fact checks I think are fantastic.
And we've lost ABC fact check, of course.
Yeah, the pity that the ABC has gone. But I found the fact checks in the US to be fantastic following the campaign there. I mean, for example, if you've seen the three debates between Trump and Clinton, as soon as they're finished, someone publishes a transcript of the whole thing. You know, NPR's done some really great ones. And they've noted throughout the script what claims have been made, and then there's experts responding or whatever, if Trump says, oh, I didn't say that, there's a link to where he did say it, and that kind of thing. And I think that's great.
Fact-checking. Yeah. Okay. Mm. Matt, just quickly.
No, I would think, and I don't have all the answers, but it would how be to put someone maybe in charge of it, of how to make the policy, big policy debates more shareable and more interesting in a digital sense during the campaign and less controlled by the outlets themselves.
That's interesting. Mark?
Resources in swing seats. So just genuinely, like, well, you can go on the bus all you want, but you miss what's happening in Queensland with
Tasmania.
Pauline. You miss the northern Tasmanians. All three Liberals lost their seats in Tasmania and no one knew it was happening. Like, how did we miss that story? It's just like I would love more money to go to Mackay, to go to Bass, down in Tassie, to go wherever.
So more local journalism,
more local
really.
Journalism. Mm.
And Andy?
Yeah, I think it'd be really good if we could somehow force the leaders to, you know, tweet several times a day from their own camp, from their own accounts, without any massaging from their people, and really get to know what they're like.
Oh, you naive idealist. Okay, we'll go to questions from the audience. Now, first up, we do have microphones. Please wait for them to get to you and be aware that the session's being recorded. And can we have questions, not statements? I'm going to be a bit strict and close you down if we get any political speeches.
Sure. I've had a bit of involvement with local and state government around lobbying councillors and state members, and their awareness of things like Twitter is pretty low. So if you can sort of set up three Twitter accounts or get, you know, three people from your group to tweet to the said councillor or member, especially at the local government level, they'll come in the next week and say, oh, God, there's a movement out there. There's a movement. You know, like, this is a real issue. And all you've done is tweet three times over the course of, say, a week, so not even that, you know, that often. Do you get in federal politics a situation where, because of one tweet or two or three tweets or a Facebook post, that a party or a politician just changes direction?
I think that just on that, if a Facebook post goes viral, this is something I'm baffled by, because a lot of people don't know, is that most newsrooms have what we're talking about, tools to actually see what's the most viral Facebook post that day. So a great example would be a woman posted to Facebook about her chemotherapy charges going through the roof and linking it to Medicare, and someone posted it to me on Twitter and said, this is happening, and I said, it was going viral on Facebook, and I literally just sent it to Susan Lee, the health minister's staffer, and I said, do you know anything about this? And Susan Lee replied to the person saying, please get in contact with me, because that should not be how it works. And that's how the system worked. You have someone mouthing off and you had the health minister replying. I wrote a story a couple of weeks ago about a mining lobby creating fake Twitter accounts to talk about renewable energy. When I went to the mining lobby and I confronted them about it, they said, oh, no, we're being astroturfed. We're not astroturfing. So, look, I think it's problematic, and it's the reason why you need to listen to social media, and then you need to know when to not listen. And I think that's the most important thing, is that you need to know when to listen to real people who aren't keyboard warriors.
Anybody else want to comment on that one?
I mean, it's incredibly, in a way, it's incredibly democratizing that people can access politicians in this way, that they can access the media in this way. So I think it's overall it's a great thing, and it is democratizing, but you do need to be careful about it. And you know there are a whole lot of experts out there in social media who can very much give the impression that something's much bigger and more important than it actually is. And so you just need to be aware of it.
Yeah. Any other comments, or should we take another question? Take another question then.
Hi, everybody. The discussion you were having before, the discussion you were having before reminded me of an article that I read, kind of quite, that was written quite a few years back, which was talking about the way in which the portrayal of politics in media, and this was the view of both kind of media scholars and journalists, had grown increasingly cynical over time, over a generation. And there was this kind of anti-politics bias in coverage and an increasing sort of shift towards infotainment. But this article kind of ran this line about it that's interesting. I'm just going to quickly read this line before posing my question. Because the argument by Michael Schutzen was that journalists' apparent cynicism stems from the same factors that have made news increasingly plentiful, credible, and analytical. These factors include journalists' declining deference to authority, greater professionalism, growing emphasis on thematic coherence, and greater insistence on providing coherent and comprehensive news. Now, that all sounds pretty good, and I'd also sort of venture to say, that's you guys. But is it a problem when sort of cynicism becomes the name of the game?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I'm going to go to you on that first, Kathy.
I think it's definitely a problem in the US at the moment. I mean, Trump is a big one who's been saying that the media is all in a left-wing conspiracy against him. But surveys show that people don't trust the media. I don't quite know why. I mean, certainly there are some media that I wouldn't trust, but there's a lot of great reporting going on as well. I think maybe a lot of people are kind of in an echo chamber where they're reading stuff that they want to hear, and this has meant that organisations like Breitbart, which is this right-wing pro-Trump website in the US, it's getting a lot of traction. I think its audience is bigger than the LA Times or something, and it has, you know, lots of conspiracy theories in it, but it disseminates misinformation, basically. I mean, its chairman is the head of Trump's campaign. But maybe, I don't know, maybe people can't distinguish good information from bad information, so they sort of tune out from the whole lot. I don't know.
Andy, how do people share cynicism? Do they share cynicism or do they share idealism?
That's a great question.
Love shares always work better than hate shares.
That's
just a fact of, but like I can say now, people share things they love more than they hate. This is just a fact.
Hmm.
Yeah. I mean, what we see from our data is that people are sharing to, for the most part, for the majority of sharing, is to take a stand on an issue, to show where they sit on an issue. Hmm. So with gay marriage, people are sharing that content to make a statement about the way they feel about things. Generally what we've seen is that, like I said, these are issues that people care deeply about. It really gets to what people share really gets to their values. And so that, that generally is a less cynical place and a more idealistic place.
Can I just say to the questioner, I mean, like, what's the alternative? Like, journalists like fawn over like good policy. I mean, it's sort of like, it's kind of that thing of being, I'm a massive cynic, but I'm an optimist. Like I will cover the politicians when they're doing well, but like I'm really cynical and I'm cynical on both sides. Like I'm not left or right. I'll hit Shorten as hard as I hit Turnbull. A great example of someone who is like, for me, like the optimist, like just totally is killing it, is like Samantha Maiden in the News Corp papers. Like, you try to tell me, like, people were like, oh, she's right-wing. It's like, Like, you see how hard she hits on the other. Like, when she hits Turnbull and when she hits Joe Hockey and when she hits hard. And she hits hard on policy, like on childcare, on stuff like that. And it's sort of like declining trust in institutions is not just confined to the media. It's and I don't think that cynicism is the problem. I think cynicism is healthy. Cynicism is probably the most important fact, Matt, in political journalism.
I'd much rather be more sceptical or cynical rather than fawning and adoring. But I know it is a thought that sometimes everything now, and I know I think Sean Kelly at The Monthly's written that everything now is an outrage and we're constantly outraged and sometimes we perhaps don't distinguish between what is important to be outraged. And this is probably for the readers rather than journalists, but it's whether we feed this, whether we distinguish between what we should and shouldn't be outraged about. One example was, I know when Malcolm Turnbull gave $5 in Melbourne to a homeless person on the street, and this provoked quite a lot of outrage about why he hadn't given $50 and whether he shouldn't have given anything at all because it's encouraging begging. And I think a lot of us did think that day, geez, should we even be reporting on this at all? But it was a hugely interesting issue to people, and everyone, and because everyone can relate to that, we've all been travelling and we've all thought, do I give money, don't I give money? But to see the Prime Minister being kicked for that, you think, geez, that's pretty rough, to be being attacked for giving someone $5.
Is there a difference between being sceptical and being cynical?
Yeah, I mean, it's a good definitional difference. I think that you're probably right. I mean, sceptical is probably the name that you put to it rather than cynicism, because I think cynicism has a pretty pejorative connotations. All I would say is that, like, you know, the thing that I've realised more and more is that stories where you can pull back the curtain and sort of show the ugly side of policymaking and show how things have like show the ugly side of politics, the audience love that. Like, the audience love being shown how the sausage is made. And I think that feeds into that cynical side of people about how they view their politicians. All I would say is like, do not tell me that, like, Bob Hawke wouldn't have been amazing in 2016 with the internet. Like, he would have been a killer, like, on social media. Like, good politicians are good politicians. We just, at the moment, are struggling a bit with our good politicians.
Okay, we'll take another question.
Hi, I'm a journalist at a small local newspapers group in Chelsea, Frankston.
Could you just lift the microphone up a little higher, sir?
In the Chelsea, Frankston and Mornington Peninsula area. So I do speak to federal, state and council politicians regularly. Does the panel think that taking selfies and posting them on Facebook and Twitter damages journalists' reputations and makes audience sees believe that journalists are on the side of the politicians and not the audience?
Strong agree.
How do you take a selfie?
I don't know. can I just say on that, like, as my editor Simon will attest, I have a complete ban on taking photos with politicians. It sends such a bad signal, and posting them onto Twitter and Instagram and whatever, it's, you could not get a worse optic to send to your audience, taking a selfie with a politician, and you'll never see it on BuzzFeed.
What do you think, Matthew?
I might have taken one. I think I got one. I got one with Pauline Hanson at the Midwinter Ball this year, and it did really well. So I'm sorry. Oh, I was happy with that photo.
Pauline Hanson sitting there at the table, and Matthew goes, I just have to get a selfie with Pauline. And I was like, mate, I was like, yeah, burn in hell with that one, mate.
I don't think I've been writing up propaganda for One Nation every day. No, I know what you mean. It's probably a problematic look. You wouldn't want to do it all the time. It's probably up to each reporter. Sometimes I think there's a bit of a thing with older reporters criticising younger reporters for being part of a younger generation. It's like, well, you're just of a different age and you have different standards, and perhaps it's a different era now where you post more and share more, and everyone has to walk the line of what they think is acceptable because we live in an online age.
It's an interesting question, I think, because there is a much more of a trend to the reporter being kind of a personality. You know, people know names, and you build up your own brand. But when I started out in journalism sort of 15 years ago, you know, you weren't part of the story. Like, that, it was bad if you put yourself in the story. And I think that's been a big change. I'm not sure whether it's a good change.
You had some...
Yeah, well, I think it is a generational thing. It comes back to social media distribution as well, the way that you tell your story through social, the way that you can access your audience directly through social, the fact that journos are more personalities, I think, than they used to be, or they certainly have a chance to exhibit personality through their social media broadcasts. I think it's generational. Like, my generation doesn't really take selfies that often, although at drinks last night with your boss, he took a selfie with Michelle Guthrie.
It's because he's shameless.
And then he tweeted that picture with a quote that basically threw her under the bus, saying that Twitter's going to be dead in a year. So
yeah.
there was one in the first week with Bill Shorten. I don't know why it happened, but this photo was made where the photographers took a photo. This is weird. The photographers on the bus took a photo of Bill Shorten taking a selfie with all of us journalists. And it was used in news stories and everything. And I must admit, now when I see it, we all participated in it just because we were asked to, and we were bored. But now it does make me cringe a little bit. Well, we were there reporting on him. Should we have been in this selfie with him?
When a journalist takes a selfie with a famous person, and I, after Simon took that selfie with Michelle, I got him to take one of me with Michelle. So I'm guilty of this as well. But
that's not a selfie, though.
You're really boasting about access, though, aren't you?
Yeah,
you're saying, look at me, here I am with the person making the news. And that's, well, it's a complicated thing and probably more complicated than we have time to discuss. What time for one more quick question, and the answers will also have to be quick, I'm afraid.
Hi, I'm just wondering about this tension between having to get the news or the photo out quickly and doing a quality report. Our family did photography for 6 months for the Greens, so it's a personal issue. But also wondering also about Facebook Live. And so, for instance, do you have a bad iPhone picture versus a good quality but much later professional picture? How do you put that in? And the same equivalent when it comes to text.
Speed versus quality.
And whether you sort of let things out over a variety of different platforms with different speeds.
Just to answer in short, I know now there's, and it's even in the time I've been at Fairfax over 3 years, there's an incredible pressure to get it done quickly. You can't deny that. You'll get in trouble if you get it wrong. They don't want you to get it wrong. But if everyone else is writing it first, in an election campaign or not, you're going to get in trouble, and you don't want to get a reputation as someone who's very slow. So you have to try and master both. And that means if you don't know, then you don't write it, because it's the fact now that in the internet age there's an incredible commercial pressure to have the story first.
I think that just on those two things, photography, professional photography and social media is a field that's been not really touched as much as it could have. Andrew Ellinghausen and Andrew Mears. No, but the Ellinghausen and Mears are the two best photographers in the press gallery for social media. The way that they're putting stuff out on Instagram, watch this space when it comes to Snapchat, because if Andrew Mears starts figuring out Snapchat, it's going to blow everyone away. And then the second thing, just on that, I'm fascinated by the Times, the UK Times, decision, I think it was last year, to abandon breaking news. And I think that that's a strong play, and they've said it takes up too much of our time because we have to, you know, run around chasing tails, and instead what they're doing is they're an agenda-setting newspaper, and they're holding back all their content for the morning. And I think that's fascinating, and it'll be interesting to see whether the Oz do the same thing here, which is abandon breaking news. But for us, we have to get it.
Andy and Kathy, just briefly comment from it.
Yeah, I think that particularly with photography, that, you know, the way that we're receiving and taking photos has changed. It is a lot lo-fi. I think people accept lo-fi quickly if it tells the story it needs to. And then, of course, you know, there is the more artistic or the more analytical that can come afterwards.
Yeah, I totally agree with that. And just on timelines generally, I totally agree with Matt. It's a lot of pressure to get out something very quickly, and you have to file for a lot of platforms. It's very difficult.
Yes, I can imagine. Okay, we are out of time. We could go on all day, but we are out of time. But please join me in thanking our panel.
Thanks for listening to the Wheeler Centre podcast. Don't forget to visit wheelercentre.com for the best in books, writing and ideas from Melbourne, Australia and the world.